Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, I am chatting with John Kaiser. He is the founder and editor of Kaiser Research. Now, John, what we're going to start here is a bit of a discussion on the rare earths sector. This sector has been heating up here, and a lot of, or I guess some new interest is coming into it. I still think investors broadly are a bit distracted by some of the other commodities and the runs that they are on. But I want to just kick off this rare earths discussion, and I do want to actually turn this into more of a series, something that you and I will touch on approximately every month. First and foremost, so let's go through the history of rare earths. The last time rare earth metals were, well, on everyone's radar was back in 2010 and 2011 when prices soared 10 to 20 times. This all revolved around China and what they were doing in the rare earth sector. John, give us a little bit more of a background of what happened about a decade ago, 2010, 2011.
Well, China emerged in the 80s and 90s, in the 2000s, as the world's dominant rare earth producer, both for light rare earths from the giant Bayan-Obo deposit, which is about 4% light rare earths, and also the heavy rare earths, which is a more obscure rare group. And they mine these from these ionic clay deposits in southeastern China, which is very low grade, but they have an abundance of this material, and it's to some degree it's run by small-scale criminal organizations. It's very inefficient recovery, very polluting, and both the giantness of Bayan-Obo and the nature of these heavy rare earth operations had produced a quite low price for rare earths in general, which was great for end users but not good for any deposits elsewhere in the world. And China in 2010 used the excuse of a fishing boat incident in the Senkandu Islands, which are disputed with Japan, to ratchet up a quota system, which perversely cranked up the price of the light rare earths. And then, of course, the Chinese themselves started hoarding the all the rare earths, so the heavies went up, and these prices went up 10-15 times. And eventually that all fell apart because companies started thrifting with their dysprosium and their terbium, which is needed for the neomagnets, whose primary input are neodymium and praseodymiums. And these were all part of the emerging electric vehicle industry. In the initial form, it was the hybrids, the Priuses and that, which required this. But we had a massive price collapse after about 2012, and prices have been very low, too low for any of these deposits that the juniors dug up in that 2010 to 2012 period to be viable. But now we have this big power problem emerging between the United States and China, and everybody has become aware again on the reliability of Chinese supply of both heavy and light rare earths. And with the Biden presidency coming in, even though the electric vehicle space was evolving, with or without Trump's support, now it's being supercharged. And the problem of, well, can we rely on these magnet materials, the rare earths that are useful for these magnet materials, to come from China? So there's a lot of talk now of reviving interest, and MP Materials has now gone public. It owns the Mountain Pass mine, and it's working on putting that back into production in 2022.
Okay, so John, because, again, China controls so much of this production, is it important then to look for companies, look for resources outside of China, all playing the fact that you would just assume that countries want some sort of protection from policies that come strictly out of China?
Yeah, well, one of the big themes now in this whole era of deglobalization is over-reliance on single-source supply chains. And so we're looking for diversity. And that's still a problem, but the rare earths, ones like lanthanum and cerium, which have some basic uses that aren't really part of the whole electric vehicle green technology industry, those are still very low, and they are the bulk of these light rare earth deposits. But it is the need to have these other ones on a sustainable, relatively stable price basis, which is forcing companies to look at projects which technically, if you take the China price, are still underwater. But it's this whole idea of ESG certifiability. If you're selling your Tesla as a clean vehicle, you cannot use raw materials from a place like China where everything is coal powered and the production methods are quite environmentally poor compared to elsewhere. You need a pricing system where the price of ESG certified rare earths is higher than it is in coming from China. And right now, I think China will be able to continue to supply the light rare earths because it has such a huge abundance. But the heavy rare earths, those are very problematic because those ionic clay deposits, they have a finite life. And China will become more concerned about preserving that resource for domestic needs and not making that more available. So back in 2009, the initial focus was on the heavy rare earths, but because of the way China manipulated the quotas, the whole rare earth space went way up, and the heavy rare earth story became sort of an also-ran. But I think right now the heavy rare earth story is gaining interest again, because everybody knows China itself has a supply problem and it will change the rules to serve its domestic interests in that regard.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that is, I think, one of the reasons why I think we do need to look outside of China on some of these companies that are bringing projects back online. But John, you even mentioned there that one of the aspects of rare earths that at least the end users, the companies that are building technology devices, they want stable prices, right? Because if prices get too high, too out of hand, then they're going to look for substitutions. They're going to try to bring on or utilize other metals. How do you balance that out as an investor, understanding that it's not something like gold that can just run higher based on external factors? When these type of rare earth metals run higher, companies look elsewhere.
Well, the rare earth prices are still 10-15% of their peaks in 2010-11. And they're never going back to those levels because then the cost became so insanely high that you don't even want to use these materials. And that did give the heavy rare earth users a bit of a reprieve because the response was thrifting and substitution. So that now you need a lot less dysprosium and terbium to mix in with your neodymium for the permanent magnet, so that when you get the higher operating temperatures, the magnetism doesn't decay and it stops working as a permanent magnet. So they're able to do a lot more with a lot less. So there is, for the heavy rare earths, there is a bit of resiliency to higher prices. So we could see, doubling maybe from current levels up before it stabilizes. But I think the key is one has to start looking at the source of the product. How was it developed? What are its carbon dioxide emission numbers? And we need the end users to be willing to commit. And that's where this thing Robert Friedland has been an investor in ABEX Technologies that's supposed to go public after completing an RTO in a couple of weeks. It's a type of electronic market apparently based on blockchain, a distributed ledger, which will allow metal supply that's different grades, quality purity grades, and also different source certifiability grades, like how much carbon dioxide was used to produce this. What are the other social license criteria in it, and create a market so that boutique users such as a Tesla, which wants to be able to say that its nickel input is clean and not coming from Russia's awful Norilsk operation, can go in there and buy it and perhaps even pay a premium price. So this is a technological solution coming in, which will allow these deposits outside of China to establish a premium pricing over what comes out from from China with you know, everything just dumped into one refiner smelter. Who knows what the source was? And that's where I think you go back to the better projects that were discovered in the previous cycle, and you start thinking higher prices are coming. And in the case of the heavy rare earths, terbium and dysprosium have gone up, and so have neodymium and praseodymium. And that's because the magnet demand is starting to rise. After the slump this year due to COVID, things are starting to turn around, definitely in China. But what's really interesting is that yttrium, which is the heavy rare earth that dominates these heavy rare earth deposits and is the equivalent of cerium or lanthanum in the light rare earth deposits, it has also started to creep up. And that makes no sense because its primary usage in lighting technology has been displaced, and there is nothing new for, you know, driving demand for yttrium that would explain its price rising. That's a clue that perhaps the supply of heavy rare earths from the Chinese ionic clay deposits is starting to diminish, and that even the regular usage of yttrium is starting to experience higher prices. So I'm optimistic we will see the heavies move up significant, not crazily like last time, but enough to start making projects like Norachar and Loftal interesting. And in the context of this ESG certifiability, a way for them to develop offtake markets that enable them to have a long-term higher price, even if China does end up dumping into the market again.
So, John, because the rare earths sector ran so much a decade ago, there was a lot of money raised, and you've even brought up a lot of projects that got attention 10 years ago and that had a lot of money put into them and that are generally a bit more de-risked than really anything new exploration-wise. Do you think that's where investors need to be looking then, is at these projects that were on everyone's radar 10 years ago, rather than driving down into some of these new exploration plays? And I do have to say, some of the new exploration plays, they seem like simply companies that are following this trend, trying to just move into rare earths because there might be some more money flowing in here.
Well, back in the 2009 to 11 cycle, people like Jack Lifton used to complain that, oh, there's 200 companies that are supposedly in rare earth exploration. But those ones looking for rare earth deposits didn't really matter. It was the deposits that were found decades ago, but found lacking in terms of grade and location. Those were the ones that were revisited. And a lot of work was done to, you know, do 43-101 resource estimates and these things, they sit there. The really hard part with rare earth deposits is the cracking stage, which is getting the rare earths out of their mineralogical prisons. And there are a whole range of different minerals that with varying degrees of energy cost to get it out. And the real stage is, can you get a flow sheet going that gets these rare earths out at a cost that is less than the value of what you can get for these rare earths? So Leading Edge Materials did a lot of work on Norachar in Sweden. It's not super high grade, only 0.84%. There's the Strange Lake deposit, which ended up in bankruptcy. It's now owned by a private group. That's probably the best heavy rare earth deposit in the world, but it's in a fairly remote location, and it has its metallurgical challenges. And then there are simpler ones like Namibia Critical Metals Loftal deposit in Namibia, in which JOGMEC is now owning 75%. And JOGMEC, which is this sort of government organization that helps its companies, the country's companies, secure raw material supply, it understands that heavy rare earth material is going to be a problem down the road coming from China, which is its rival. And it will put this Loftal project into production. It has separation capacity in-house. This is another big problem for the heavies, is separation capacity. In the United States, Lynas has backing from the government to build a heavy rare earth separation facility, which they don't have the supply yet to separate heavies. But Japan does have internal heavy rare earth separation. So Namibia Critical Metals Loftal project, even though they net only 25%, that's going to end up being worth something down the road. In the case of Nora Char, their challenge is to overcome the environmental opposition. And so they're looking at new approaches, such as taking the nepheline syenite, which is the primary host for them, the minerals that contain the rare earths, somehow separate that and turn it into a marketable product rather than tailings dump. And of course, disposing of the thorium, which is a byproduct, that is what freaks out a lot of jurisdictions about having a rare earth mine in their backyard. Being able to make sure that thorium goes back into the ground in a similar dilute form, that's also going to be a key part. So it's more the like advanced stage of these projects, and that's capital intensive. So we have a big boom coming. The money's not going to go into poking holes at carbonatite targets somewhere else and come up with a brand new discovery that can be delineated within a year or two of extensive drilling. It's going to be the heavy lifting of demonstrating that you have a flow sheet and a method by which you deal with any of the radioactive byproducts that may be in the system.
All right, John, we're going to wrap it up here. That's a lot to take in for our initial, more or less, introduction to the rare earth sector. But as I mentioned, we are going to be continuing to touch on the rare earths approximately every month, or at least as much as news warrants or any developments in the rare earth sector. If anybody has any follow-up comments regarding the rare earth sector, any companies that they think are interesting, please comment below, or even better, email me directly, fleck@kereport.com, and John and I will discuss those on one of our future interviews. John, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome, Corey.